Welcome to Manager Tools. The Manager Tools Data, One-on-Ones, Part 3. This cast answers these questions. What data do you have to support the use of one-on-ones? What do tests show of one-on-ones? What do the data say about the frequency of one-on-ones? Well, if you want answers to these questions and more, keep listening. Here we go.
Hey y'all, it's Sarah here, letting you know about a rare upcoming opportunity to see all three of our presenters at one event. Kate, Mark, and myself will be presenting our Effective Hiring Manager Conference, better known as the Effective Interviewer Conference, in Palo Alto on March the 12th. The student-teacher ratio at this one will be excellent. Register online at manager-tools.com/training, and we all hope to see you there.
All right, Mark, so last time we talked about the Trinity derivation data, how we got data around the Trinity and how we came up with the Trinity. And today we're going to talk about specifically one-on-ones and results and retention data.
Yeah, it's funny. You use the classic phrase, how did you come up with the Trinity? And I tell people all the time, I didn't. We didn't.
The data are overwhelming. These are the things we should do.
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah, that was well known before we came along. All we did was create tools. So the first study, as opposed to a survey, but an actual study we ever led, gosh, 25 years ago, oh, it's longer than that now, was to determine the validity of one-on-ones to address organizational communication and results and retention. And it was a near complete failure, in fact.
Keep talking, otherwise people are going like, why are you teaching this stuff?
Yeah, exactly. This is great. Hey, look, we have spent too long telling people we're going to tell it like it is to just only give them the icing. We want to give them the cake too here a little bit. So we were hired to assist a senior VP who was having trouble communicating his message of change in an organization of about 2,500 employees. Basically, what we did was we said, you can't do enough. You can't do enough town halls. You've got to do one-on-ones, and you've got to rely on the organization's managers. Yeah, you could meet with the managers, but you just can't be meeting with everybody all the time. And this is a long time ago, before email was super prevalent, before there was digital technologies and so on to make these things easier. There weren't TVs in every office. There weren't, you know, high definition video feeds and so on. Anyway, we created an early version of one-on-ones to create opportunities for managers to communicate the leader's vision and for the manager to continue communicating it down to carry the water, as it were. We made a huge mistake in the first initial work because we had managers go first in those one-on-ones. And look, it made total sense at the time because managers always go first. And we just wanted to get managers and directs in the same room. We weren't really as concerned with building trust as we were giving the organization a vehicle, because that's what we were hired to do. And it was it was certainly top five seminal moments in terms of my career, in terms of going after something and getting enough data to go, no, you're just wrong. I mean, it's not like, yeah, the data doesn't support you. It's just, no, you're wrong. You're really wrong. And by the way, it affected our billing of the client. But basically, instituting one-on-ones where the manager went first. And by the way, folks, until we tested it, we just guessed at 30 minutes. We later discovered with data that 30 minutes is the ideal length of time for one-on-ones. But in this one, we just guessed. But that survey, that study, led to a reduction in results and retention of about 1%. And they stopped doing the one-on-ones.
I wonder why.
Yeah. I mean, smart. Okay. But some other really interesting data came out of the study. One manager, a director who had 26 subordinate managers in his organization, cheated because he was lazy, basically. And he said, Mark, I didn't want to prep for another meeting I was going to have with my people. So I said, why don't we have the directs go first over here? We're not going to tell anybody. We're just going to do it that way. And that way it's a different vehicle, but I'm still going to get my chance to put in my two cents about what the SVP is doing. And his group had noticeable, positive, sustained improvements in results. Literally the exact opposite of the other, you know, hundreds of managers in the study. And we basically learned, in addition to getting the results, we learned a valuable lesson that going first was way more important than we realized. And then, in fact, trying to help the organization get its message out was less valuable, depending upon how you look at things, was much less valuable than building trust in the recipient of that message. If Mike's my boss and I trust him, you can give him a lot of training about how to communicate with me, or you can worry about my trust of him. If I have high trust, he doesn't even have to be terribly good at communicating the message. Whereas if I have low trust, it doesn't matter how good a communicator he is, unless you're willing to be unethical.
Yeah. You're not that smart and they're not that dumb, right?
Yeah, at some level, yeah. When managers went first in the early one-on-ones that they were doing before we shut down that study, the managers talked for an average of 28 minutes. Now, think about that. This is a meeting that they've been told, hey, half a meeting. Yeah. And the manager basically takes over. And that's, I think, because they know they have the power. By the way, what does a smart direct say when a manager says, oh gosh, I've been talking for 28 minutes. We've got 2 minutes left. Do you have anything for me?
None, boss.
They're going to say, no, I'm good. And the manager's like, hey, this is great. I get to talk to them about what they need to be doing. And the directs come away and go, yeah, this stinks. But in the other group, where the directs went first, surreptitiously sort of, they talked as well for 28 minutes. Now, I don't think that's just about going first. I think that's a function of pent-up need for communication. And I always think of that study when I think of managers and directs who say, oh, we talk all the time. I mean, the biggest problem, we'll talk about this later in one-on-ones in terms of once you start implementing, is not what managers think, which is my people won't have anything. That's actually not the big problem. The big problem, six times more likely than directs not talking, is directs talking too much. And all this talk that we, you know, it's sometimes it's hard for me not to roll my eyes in front of an audience. I'm sure that's true for Kate and Sarah as well, that you, you know, they say, oh, I don't have time. So yeah, okay. Take 2 one-on-ones and call me in 6 weeks and see what happens. And then we find out later, oh gosh, we're talking all the time. It's, you know, it's all kinds of stuff. Like, okay. So in other words, you were talking all the time before and you thought therefore you knew enough. Now you've basically created a concentrated time for talking. It's still not enough. Surely that makes you realize you were wrong before. Just wrong. And look, if you're not willing to admit you're wrong, dude, that's a dangerous place to be. And look, in this study that we did, in both cohorts, managers going first and directs going first, to be clear, we didn't have a direct going first cohort. We had a manager cheating a little bit. They felt they were talking plenty on a day-to-day basis, okay? These were largely, I think, almost exclusively co-located managers and their teams. This is a datum that has repeated itself routinely, not every time, in our work. Virtually everyone thinks they talk enough to their counterparts, and then the vast majority of early one-on-ones run long with both sides having far more to share than they predicted. This is a thematic occurrence whenever we study one-on-ones and behaviors around them, regardless of results and retention scores, which are not the icing on the cake. They're the cake, but still.
Right. You did a second large-scale one. I think this one had more than 1,000 managers testing one-on-ones.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And this was the one that really cemented it for me and caused me to want to do more studies, which are not easy to get clients to agree to. But I really felt like we had a distinct advantage in that we had data. So we had over 1,000 managers. We had roughly 700 of those managers in a test group. And that test group was broken down into 3 subgroups, weekly one-on-ones, bi-weekly one-on-ones, and monthly one-on-ones. We also had a control group of roughly 400 managers. You know, I went back and looked at some of my notes. The test group was actually supposed to be roughly the same size as the others. And it ended up being more because a bunch of managers who were put into the control group was supposed to be the same size as the test groups. But things work a little better that way. The math is a little bit easier and so on, assuming randomness of normal positional moves and so on. But we had a bunch of managers of this company opt out. They said, no, I don't want to do one-on-ones. I want to be in the control group. And frankly, much to the chagrin of the scientists who were there, the statisticians and so on, they were like, yeah, this isn't good. But I said, you know, okay, fine. We'll just tell the client we're not doing it and we'll walk away. You don't have a job. I don't have a job. And they said, no, it's still scientifically valid. It's still useful. And so we allowed people who didn't want to do one-on-ones to not do them. Now, the great part about that was, as you'll see in a minute, that reduced the damage of some of what happened once we started doing one-on-ones in the test group. Now, look, in this study, I don't know that I've ever heard of a longer one. We were scheduled to follow all 1,100 managers for 30 months. 2.5 years, which is, folks in our business, a very long, very expensive engagement. Now, regrettably, we had to abort the measurements after 19 months when managers learned through a promotion report that wasn't related to our stuff. This was just normal. Hey, here's a promotion report. People have been promoted and so on. That virtually every manager promoted in the previous 18 months, and the reason I mentioned 19 months is 1 month later, we stopped the test, that virtually every manager promoted in the previous 18 months had come from the test group.
Right. And not as a result of those folks in the control group having opted out and being discriminated against in some way, but rather as a result of the results.
Right. Yeah, that's what happened. In 18 months, we had statistically significant improvements in results from retention to the point where, you know, the managers who were in the test groups were like, this is...
Yeah, they're rocking it, and so therefore, they get promoted, right? Okay. Right.
Yeah. The problem that created, and the reason we stopped the test, was the control group, who weren't supposed to be doing one-on-ones, and who we were measuring to not do one-on-ones, started doing one-on-ones. And unfortunately, in the business, that violated the study's integrity, and so we had to shut down the study, which totally stunk for me.
I can imagine you getting all sad about people adopting O3s and improving results.
Well, yeah, but it shortened the engagement. I mean, look, we're still a for-profit corporation, right? So, yeah. But nevertheless, our relationship with this client was unassailable after that. They were like, oh, yeah, we have data. When other people would say, you know, you ought to consider this or you ought to consider that. The company's like, yeah, no. All we need to do is have all our managers do one-on-ones. By the way, we're going to come back to that company when we deliver our feedback data as well. Now, we captured results and retention improvements from all four groups, weekly, biweekly, monthly, and control, during that 19 months. Here's what's interesting. Obviously, as you might imagine, weekly one-on-ones greatly outperformed all other test groups in results and retention improvement. 8%. Actually, we've repeated this and have gotten 8 to 9 and so on, although different sizes of studies and so on. And folks, if you don't know it, as a general rule, the way we calculate this, 10% improvement in results and retention is exceptionally hard to achieve. So don't assume, oh, I'm only going to get 10% of this, 10% improvement, because 10% in a 6 or 8 month period sustainable is astronomically high. The second biggest improvement came from biweekly one-on-ones. They got a 3% improvement. When we get this big of data, I'm just rounding because I don't want to go 3.21 and then have somebody say, you sure it's 3.21 and not 0.20? We're not doing that here. By the way, I found it interesting, and we found this every single time we've ever tested weekly versus biweekly. The fact that the biweekly one-on-one improvement is around 40% of the results and retention improvement we get from weeklies is fairly normal from our comparative tests. We've seen it as low as 25% if you do it biweekly. In other words, the biweekly people are getting 25% of the improvement that the weekly people are. And we've seen it up to 45% of the weekly. We have never seen managers who do bi-weekly one-on-ones in any of our studies ever achieve half, 50% of the improvements in results and retention that the managers who do weekly one-on-ones do. In my opinion, that's significant if you're a data guy. And we have, you know, Mike and I have talked before that we think our audience skews more left on the DISC model, more logical, rational, linear, data-driven, and so on. And I don't think when you hear and see this data that you can say, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to ignore that data. If you've been arguing for more data and then you get the data, you say, I dismiss it and so on, I would politely suggest to you that you're just looking for reasons to not do anything different, which is fine, but that'll probably keep you stuck in your career. Basically, biweekly one-on-ones are less efficient than weekly one-on-ones. From a time investment standpoint, they should deliver 50% of the improvement, but they never have, never seen it. Also, biweekly one-on-ones have a much lower long-term compliance rate in our study than weekly one-on-ones. Biweekly one-on-one manager cohorts have a roughly 60% completion rate compared to weekly one-on-ones. Managers who do biweekly one-on-ones are nearly twice as likely to drop out of studies than weekly one-on-one managers. It would be really hard to interview those people, find out what it was, and draw anything more than anecdotal conclusions, but we think it's a function of periodicity. Irregular periodicity, how often you do one-on-ones, seems harder for lots of people to keep up with. If you do something daily, you're much more than twice as likely to remember it and to do it daily as if you do it every other day. For some reason, daily versus every other day, I don't think that's bi-daily, by the way. I don't know what that is. And the same thing, weekly, which is our next time delineator, versus biweekly, people just have a much better likelihood of being able to adjust habitually to those frequencies. By the way, the group that came in first was weekly one-on-ones. The group that came in second was biweekly one-on-ones. Obviously, the assumption is that monthly one-on-ones will come in third and they all beat. You know, monthly one-on-ones give you some modicum of improvement above the baseline. And the baseline, of course, would be the control group doing no one-on-ones. But in fact, that's not what we found, nor has that ever been what we found when we've tested these four behavior groups against one another. The group that places third every time and results in retention improvement was the control group with a marginally zero improvement or decline.
The control group was third, meaning the monthly was last?
That's right.
That means it did worse.
Okay. In the four times we included monthly periodicity in our studies, monthly one-on-ones produced lower results and retention scores than doing nothing at all. Guys, you know, as we said before, numbers don't lie, but we all lie about numbers. So you always have trouble drawing conclusions, and you may choose to draw different conclusions from our data, and that's fine. We certainly respect that. When I read studies, when I read things in Harvard Business School, Harvard Business Review, when I read of other cases and things, and the conclusions that people draw from things, I find shocking, frankly. And so I've learned that the best thing to do is draw very narrow conclusions that I can stand behind and say, this is it. Now, would I say anecdotally to a friend of mine, you know, there's a bunch more here that I'm just not going to say publicly? Yeah, that's absolutely true. But I'm not doing that because I'm not going to get an argument about the quality of the data or anything else. In much the same way that laying fiber to a house, it's all about the last mile. The last mile in convincing someone else is all them. And it's not us. It's not our data. It's not the history. It's the person's biases, predilections, and so on. And frankly, we know we won't reach all managers because some managers say, managers don't like people all that much. In fact, I've said that before. I've said it to audiences in the last couple of years. I've said, I'm just actually not a people person. I'm actually not a nice guy an awful lot of the time. But I really like results and retention or being an effective manager. And so I don't do what I like, which is to say, do my own work and tell my directs to do their works and let them be, hire great people, pay them a lot of money and leave them alone. No, I don't do that. And the reason we do hire great people, we do pay them well, but we don't leave them alone because I have data that I am convinced of, and I have seen it in my own career that if I spend time with my people on a regular basis, I get better results. And if there's something I'm addicted to, it's results. It's not doing what I want to do. And I'll tell you that doing what I want to do, I come back to that. That's my theme lately, dude, because I have to tell you something. You start reading Drucker over and over again. Drucker talks about, you want to be an effective executive? Ask what the organization needs you to do. We don't care what you want to do. We don't care what you like to do. In fact, we don't even care to some degree what you're good at. We start with what you're needed to do. And from that, so many other things fall out. And for every manager, what we know, the data are irrefutable regarding human beings and organizations. I'm not suggesting that there won't be a better solution somewhere in the future that doesn't involve human beings. But as long as you've got human beings, the job of a manager includes a non-trivial amount of time spent with those people developing trusting relationships.
That's it, everyone, for this week. We'll finish this one up next week. In the meantime, have a great one. So long, folks.